You're listening to a Soundcast interview with composers Carter Burwell and Rolf Kent. I'm Kristen Romanelli. You can find more interviews in all of our episodes at thesoundcast.com, or you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Acast. Wherever you do listen, please give us a rating and a review, as it really helps us to know that you're listening, and it helps us make the show better. You can send us your feedback at soundcast@tracksounds.com via our SpeakPipe widget, on Twitter at Audio Soundcast, or on Facebook. First, we speak with Carter Burwell about his score to the Coen Brothers' Western anthology, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which was released on Netflix on November 16th. Burwell's score had a digital release on November 9th, and the Milan Records album became available on November 30th on both CD and vinyl. It was originally going to be a miniseries, so I suppose, was that how you approached the project, each story as a separate entity?
Well, as it developed, before they went to shoot it, yeah, we were looking at each one as a separate entity, and we really didn't talk about, unifying it at that point. But then after they had shot, and as they were starting to edit it, Joel and Ethan seemed to be more and more focused on trying to turn it into one film, mm-hmm. as opposed to six separate films. But of course, they'd already at that point shot it and long ago written it. It seemed like they were hoping that I would, in the very last phase of the process, turn it into one film. So I did, to find something that would tie them together. But one part of the problem was that they were editing them one at a time. So unlike a normal film where a normal feature film where you could see maybe 15 minutes of it and get a sense of what the film looks like and what the pacing of the film is, mm-hmm. and things like that, here, because they were doing them one at a time, I never actually saw the very last one until, they were a few months into editing. And so it was hard for me to conceive it all, having not even seen what the last chapter was going to look like. But anyway, I tried to find some unifying feature. But part of the fun of the film is that the different parts are, in fact, so different. Mm-hmm. Some are funny, some are tragic. In a way, I have to say that ultimately I failed. I couldn't find a thing, some theme that would just tie it all together. It was an impossible task. So what I did instead was, tried to use the those little interconnecting shots of the book that is a mechanism to tie each of the chapters to each other. Mm-hmm. I used those shots of the book as a way to get from one piece to the next, and try to create some flow so that at least you're not jarringly moving from one, the end of one story to the beginning of the next. And then we bookend the whole film with this theme, which we in America know as the Streets of Laredo. It's an old, Western mm-hmm. song. But in fact, we present it at the very end of the film, also in its original British Isles form, which was an even older folk song called The Unfortunate Lad.
I boldly stepped up to and kindly did ask him, why are you wrapped in flannel so white? My body is injured and sadly disordered, all by a young woman, my own heart's delight.
Which Brendan Gleeson sings.
Yeah, the Brendan Gleeson sings. So I did what I could to try to tie it all together, but I'd be the first to say I couldn't do the overall unifying theme that I think Joel and Ethan were hoping I would find.
So each segment, the Coens focus on, you know, certain Western archetypes in each of the stories. Did you do the same with the music? Certain pieces seem to lean, like the first one, Ballad of Buster Scruggs, leaned very Roy Rogers, and the Tom Waits segment seemed to lean very Aaron Copland.
That's certainly true. In addition to the content of the stories, the very look of each chapter is quite distinct from the others. And mm-hmm. they just even like the positioning of the cameras, they you know, I think that they definitely were thought of each chapter as, you know, being like a Western film from the 40s or from the 50s or from the 70s or mm-hmm. you know, they in the way that they shot them. And I took that, you know, or I guess I should say I began with that approach to the score, thinking that the James Franco one is much more like a, you know, Sergio Leone
yes.
or one of, you know, one of the other Italian directors who made Westerns, or whereas, yeah, the Tom Waits one looks more like a John Ford. So that I began by also positioning the music, especially in terms of its orchestration, in different periods of the tradition of making Western films. But then, in all of the cases, I have to say, if I really seemed like I was trying to cop like Dmitri Tiomkin or something, then it didn't work, because it then started to feel more like it was a, you know, a parody or an homage or mm-hmm. something like that. And in the end, it needs to feel like us. You know, it had to be, you know, the Coen Brothers film. So we did try, and often at the behest of Joel and Ethan, I would say, okay, let's make this bigger and bolder and more like, you know, Tiomkin. But we always ended up actually kind of dialing that back, because if I really did try to sound like that or Copeland or you name it, then it wasn't us anymore. It didn't seem authentic. And even though each of them, these stories, is shot in a style that owes something to different periods of filmmaking, still it has to be authentic. It has to have some authenticity. And in the end, it had to sound like us. Experiment, I think, for all of us. I think they discovered in the editing too, it was much more complicated than we expected. We would go some distance towards making it sound like it was from a period, then we'd come back and find some place in between, so that it connoted a period in filmmaking, but at the same time was authentic to, you know, to today.
What were some of the techniques and instrumentation that you used to speak to those periods?
Well, you know, I would say that for instance, the Tom Waits one, where he enters the scene singing this song "Mother McCree," which is an old Irish tune, but not really a folk tune. I believe it actually was written for a play, but or musical, but it's. Over the century it's existed, it's taken on the role of a cliche of a sappy Irish tune. So I use that as material for some of the music in that section. Mm-hmm. Then I just really orchestrate it so that it is really sappy and old fashioned. So it's then the way that it's performed is as well. But, you know, that is, I was definitely viewing it from the point of view, viewing the score from the point of view of Tom Waits' character, who is completely by himself through the entire scene, but singing a song about his, you know, his mother. And I tried to like inject that much sappiness into the orchestration. It's just very old fashioned in its use of woodwinds and, you know, vibrato in the strings and the harp, you know, you name it. Whereas there's another chapter that takes place in a wagon train going to Oregon, and that is much more bouncy and in fact jaunty, I think is the term that Ethan used for it. Right, because it's that one segment, you know, it's sort of full of hope. There, it's not, you know, if you can say that about a movie, it's about
right,
death.
Right.
It's that one is at least creating the you know, the sense of hope, and even the last chord. I kind of wanted the last chord in that segment to shift to something a little more minor, but Ethan just wanted to keep up the hope. So even though in fact everything is lost at the end of that chapter, we end on a big major tonic chord. And you know, each chapter has its own, you know, own character. The last one, which I think Joel and Ethan think of as a Rod Serling story, because it's like a TV story, because it takes place in the most limited production circumstances. It's shot inside of a stagecoach, so you can really do it live with like two cameras. You know, that one is very stripped down in its instrumentation. But actually, that's actually one of my favorites, because when you do strip, you know, the instrumentation down, every note, you know, really counts, and every instrument as it comes in is there for a particular reason, and they never hear like the whole orchestra play. It's trading off lines to accentuate the, in that case, creepiness and hopelessness of the situation that the passengers in that coach are facing. They're all, yeah, as you say, they're just all completely different. But it's, you know, I think Joel Ethan found this in the shooting and the cutting. It's also really fun to have to, every 20 minutes, put on a different hat and approach everything with a, you know, completely different palette.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems like it would be hard to get bored with it. You have these little quick arcs, and then, you know, you move on to the next.
Yeah, that's right. It is, you know, to do within 20 minutes, to do a real arc was an interesting little challenge, to say, okay, I've only got like, you know, five cues here, but I still want it to feel like we've introduced a theme, we've, you know, varied it, we've, you know, moved through some, you know, some contrasting colors and brought it then to a satisfying conclusion. And, you know, I haven't really done television, and so I don't know if that's, I don't think actually television is typically done that way, but it was like taking a film and trying to squeeze it into 20 minutes, all the things that you look for, or that I look for anyway, in writing a score. It was interesting.
Did you have a favorite story out of this?
I don't really have a favorite story. This score ended up because I sort of had to wait for Joel Nathan to finish editing the last chapter before I could really figure out what the movie was about. I know it sounds weird to say, but until I really see the entire film, I don't feel that comfortable writing a score, because I really need to know where I'm going to be, right, to begin. So because they sort of cut the chapters in order, I was waiting and waiting and waiting for them to finish the last one, and then quickly write everything. I had themes and ideas for a lot of the other chapters, but didn't really know how to tie it together until that last one existed. So even though we probably had 3 months to do this, I don't know, 2 or 3 months, it still actually mostly got written in the last 4 to 6 weeks. So it was going by very, very fast. And as I say, throwing out a lot of, trying ideas, throwing them out very fast also, because again, we weren't always sure how much we should feel like we're of a period of a previous period, how much we should feel like the present. So, when we got to the recording and finally had all the music orchestrated and on the stand, I was, thought, well, now I can actually like get some semblance of a night's sleep. And Ethan came to me and said, I think the end credits should all be an original piece of music. We shouldn't, a lot of films, they just take the score and edit together an end credit, or we could take a song or take songs, whatever. But Ethan came to me, we were actually at the recording, and said, I think we need, to really write an end credit piece like they would do for, How the West Was Won or some big old Western. And and I just kind of looked at him with my sleepy eyes and said, 5 minutes of original music. We've got like 2 days, before we finish recording. But he was serious, and went to an orchestra in New York that we've worked with since Miller's Crossing, and asked him if he could please help me figure out a way to do that, because there was just it just seemed almost impossible. But with Mr. Sonny Confident, but with Sonny's help, we did some, we got something done.
Yeah.
I still don't really know how well it works, but I know the beginning of it works, because I always knew I'd write the beginning would be original or something, but then to keep it going for 4 minutes, 4 more minutes was a challenge. But this is not an unusual story. These things, every film, something, mm-hmm. some appalling surprise comes up at the recording, and you just have to get used to that.
Yeah.
It's very typical. I always have a little setup in my hotel room when I'm doing that. I can't remember any time when I haven't been. Unfortunately, this is a normal part of this life.
Next, we speak with Rolf Kent about his work on John S. Baird's Laurel and Hardy biopic, Stan and Ollie, due out in theaters on December 28th.
Well, in 1932, I was friends with Stan and Ollie, and I promised them that at any point that they needed a different composer, that I'd make myself available. And it just turns out that 80-something years later, that's become an opportunity.
Excellent.
alternative to that, I had become acquainted with John Baird, the director, and we were chatting about various things, and then time passed, and this, and he got in touch and said, would I do his film? So it's really just the connection with me and John.
Excellent. I was curious, were you inspired by some of those old classic comedies?
Well, first up, just as a side note, I actually live at the foot of the hill that I'm on is the Music Box Steps, which is where Laurel and Hardy filmed the Music Box in 1932. So, Laurel and Hardy have always been sort of very much part of the landscape of my landscape generally. Yeah, I grew up with Sunday afternoon TV at my grandparents' place. Was the TV was on. In Britain, there was only two channels, and Laurel and Hardy were frequently on. So I was very familiar with Laurel and Hardy's oeuvre.
I love that. So it very much is written into you. What did you pull from that for Stan and Ollie?
Well, I decided not to listen back to any music of the era because I generally think the imagination plays better with a memory than with a recent experience. You know, your grip on it is so much sort of more loose and fluid, but the opportunity to sort of recreate an atmosphere that you recall and perhaps do that in a more modern way, that seems like the right way to go. That how I feel today about a memory from many years ago might be a more interesting thing to portray than something too literal or too direct. Mm. And the fact is that, you know, I have a fairly decent sense of how, silent movie music and the sort of the early talkies, that kind of music was, I have a fairly good sense of what that was like. So on top of which, the comedy of this kind of film, you know, some of it is, you know, just lifted or inspired by the comedy of Laurel and Hardy from their films. Mm-hmm. And there aren't that many different ways of approaching it while making it funny. You can't go too modern, or you'll just make it cool, but there's no fun to be had in it. And it's slapstick humor. So my score was definitely influenced by those kind of rhythms and timings that you actually need in order to make a slapstick sequence work.
For the dramatic parts of this and scoring the relationship between the two actors, tell me a bit more about that.
Both for the dramatic and the comedic. I mean, there was this idea, you know, if you think of the Dance of the Cuckoo Waltz, which is the theme tune we associate with, yes, Laurel and Hardy. I always thought it was very squeaky, but of course it has the bottom end as well. It's a boom, 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 boom. So you took this idea that the relationship was going to be sort of embodied in the relationship between the clarinet and the bassoon, a higher, you know, tone and a deeper tone, obviously for Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy. So there's a little bit of that woven through the score. But the dramatic music is rather more contemporary because, you know, I think, you know, we'd already established a sense of time and place. And so but when it comes to speaking to a real audience, today's audience, you want to be as sort of heart open and direct as possible. And so there's no need to mimic the past too much. So so it's a pretty modern approach to the dramatic stuff. It's still using an orchestra and, you know, whatever else I threw in there. But the intention is much more sort of modern and contemporary and direct.
particular challenges with this sort of film where you're scoring like a real life duo?
I don't think the real life thing made anything any different. Uh-huh. Getting the tone right, because it really is a very fine line between, dramatically between, you don't want it to become too silly and you don't want it to become too period, mm-hmm. but you also don't want to get too far away from that. Wasn't the sort of Chariots of Fire approach of having music which is completely nothing to do with the era at all, but at the same time you wanted to speak to the modern audience. So that you got there's an ongoing balancing act there between referencing the past and just speaking in a language which everyone completely gets. Yeah. So that's a challenge in itself. I mean, other challenges were things like the director not liking the end title music the day before I was got on the plane.
Oh my gosh.
So completely rewriting the entire cue, which, for the whole end titles in a day and then getting on the plane the next day. So that was a challenge.
Oh my gosh.
But, it was doable and it sounded, I'm quite very happy with the end result. I'll give you the scenario. The end titles have a lot of vintage footage, including uh-huh. a sequence of Laurel and Hardy dancing. So I'd done a piece of music which matched the rhythm of the dancing perfectly. And for some reason or other, that didn't quite gel with the director, and which baffled me. But nonetheless, he's right and I'm wrong. So I had to come up with a different idea. And thankfully, my music editor just suggested a piece of the score from earlier in the film and said, what about using something like that? Mm-hmm. And both me and the director sort of looked at each other and agreed. And so at least I had a premise. But yeah, I had to bash the cue off in a day. And it's quite a big one as well. But, it's the job, we're not writing for ourselves. Yeah. We're writing for a purpose and a reason.
The full versions of these interviews may be read on FilmScore Monthly Online's website, fsmonlinemag.com. Please consider subscribing for more interviews, score analyses, and album reviews. Follow the Soundcast on Twitter at AudioSoundcast for info on upcoming episodes, including the Soundcast 6 and Soundcast Stereo. I'm Kristen Romanelli. Thank you for listening to this Soundcast interview.